Hello, my name is Zoltán Csiges, and this is Zoltán's podcast on coaching. In this series, I'm talking with internationally renowned coaching scientists and coaches. We explore their personal and professional insights on the science of coaching and on the helping professions. Are you interested in how they got close to this profession? Are you curious about the new frontiers they are exploring right now? Join me and listen to the conversation. Inspiration and some fun is ahead. Hello, David, and welcome to the conference, EMCC Hungary's Academy for 2024, with the subtitle of Personalized Mentoring and Coaching in Alliance. Welcome. I'm so happy to have you.
I'm delighted to be. I wish I could be with you personally, but I'm on my way to Africa today to do some workshops there.
Wow, super interesting. And I wish you could bring a slice of Africa to us today, and I would be interested to explore that a bit in our conversation. There are so many things that you are researching on, writing on, and as a thought leader, you have an opinion. But to focus the conversation and the topics of the conference, I would like to ask you first about the relationship between coaching and mentoring. How you see that? Like, is it necessary to make difference between the two of these helping professions? And if so, how would you do that?
Let's look at it from two perspectives. From the perspective of the client and the perspective of the coach or mentor. From the perspective of the client, we can find zero evidence that clients care.
Wow.
They want to be able to be there, to be present, to provide them with the kind of attention and questioning and support that they need at the time. Now, there are boundaries to this because we know that if we're trying to help somebody, we help them least when we give them advice. There's this big difference between giving somebody context, which is information that helps them with the quality of their thinking, and giving them advice, which is doing the thinking for them. There's a boundary here that's outside of both coaching and mentoring. But within the scope of how we're supporting people and helping people, the client doesn't care. Entirely in the coach's head as to, or the mentor's head as to whether they feel they're slipping from one thing to the other and feeling guilty about it. In my work going around the world, talking to coaches and mentors in multiple countries, it's very clear the more mature the coaches become or the or mentors become, the less they care about this, the more they use it themselves. And this has been deeply reinforced by the work of the Coach Maturity Research Group. There are five of us in the group at the moment, and we've been picking up on the maturity research that David Meggerson and I did 20 years ago. We were using the data from assessment centers, from coach assessment centers, to look at the evolution of coaches' mental architecture, if you like, the way they thought about themselves and their identity and their relationship to their client. In that original research, we found that people very often started off with a very simplistic model, like the GROW model or something like that, which has deep limitations, let's put it that way. And what we find increasingly is around the world, people say, well, we start off with this, we realize it doesn't work in anything that's complicated, so we throw that away, and then we get on with doing some real coaching or real mentoring. And you sort of evolve from this idea that you're stuck in a particular model, doesn't work, or it leads you to basically very poor quality coaching or mentoring. But then you move to be much more open, you get more relaxed about the conversation, and you have a whole portfolio of ways you might work with somebody. And that leads to a different way of thinking about your identity as a coach or as a mentor. And then there tended to be quite a big gap as people started to integrate who they were with what they did. And it's about, you've gone from doing coaching with, to being a coach. And then finally, we found that the most mature coaches we identified and the ones who had the biggest impact were what we call systemic eclectics, because they saw the client in their systems and they took a very systemic view of the whole of client relationship. But they were very eclectic in the way that they approached things. They used themselves far more. Now, in the more recent studies with the research group, what we've done is to go out and interview very experienced coaches around the world. What we wanted to hear from them, we asked them about their journey, their learning journey in particular. How did they evolve as a coach? Surprise, surprise, one of the things that came up, the first thing they do is forget goal obsession. They realize that goals is something that emerge from the session very often, not that you start the session with. They also start to use more of themselves. So they become much more like mentors if you think that mentors are able to give more context because they've got more experience. And so the boundaries just disappear at that level. So the coach, the client doesn't care. And the most mature coaches actually blend coaching and mentoring, however you want to define them, in their practice. It doesn't actually matter. It only matters if you're a beginner and you're trying to practice very basic level coaching. Problem with that is that artificial intelligence is starting to do that better than we can. So that basic level process based, you know, following a nice and it's a step-by-step model, that can be done by an AI very well, better than the humans. And our big challenge, or one of our big challenges across the MCC and I think the whole world of coach education, is how do we help coaches to move straight to the more mature levels of being a coach as opposed to doing coaching?
Wonderful, I would say. And when in just these 3 minutes, you raised at least 12 thoughts that I wrote down and I could reflect on. Well, we could write a whole book out of this. First, let me just highlight what really caught my attention from the first part is that giving context doesn't equal to giving advice, because I think that helping clients to think with information, with background, with knowledge, with whatever, is frequently considered as wrongful input into the coaching process. And I think it's a good thing that you are clarifying that this could really fit into both coaching and both mentoring as well.
Absolutely. And there's a whole ethical issue here as well. If you hear somebody and you have some knowledge that they don't have, and that might knowledge might help them to avoid a major mistake or doing harm to themselves or to other people, do you say, oh, well, I can't give you that information because I'm in a coach mode? That's unethical.
Absolutely. You know what? The challenge in having a conversation with you is that you are one step ahead of me and you're already answering the questions I've just been. This is going to be my cool question. Like, how does ethic come into play? Cool. But building on that, I always had the idea that even such a thing as clear questioning doesn't exist, because my questions are coming from my own frame of reference, my previous knowledge, my perspectives, my whatever. So your questioning is technically giving context to my coach here or to my client.
Yeah, well, there's so many myths and nonsense out there. So the idea of non-directive, as you've just described, the moment you choose between one question and the other, you have just directed the conversation. So we have all these maxims and rules we're supposed to follow from. Mostly these come from North American ideas around what coaching should look like. And we're constantly challenging these now. We're saying, well, where's the evidence for this? And the answer is there isn't any. When we take it out of a European North American context and we go and listen to what coaching is like in other parts of the world. And again, they don't actually really distinguish between coaching and mentoring. It's about helping people to think. I've just been in the Solomon Islands. Absolutely fascinating listening to how people coach there. And I wish I'd been able to have the time to sit in on some coaching conversations, because the culture of the Solomon Islands is very rich. You know, they have hundreds of years of tribal law and custom. And we see this in a lot of societies, underdeveloped societies, underdeveloped in the modern economic sense rather than in other senses. And what fascinated me was the emphasis they put on parable and story. Now, we have in the Western world, we sort of have this knowledge of Jesus and the parables, and that people would develop wisdom in others by telling parables and stories. We've lost that. And coaching dogma, as it's promoted by some other associations, just basically, stop that. But it's a critical part of learning in so many cultures. And so what they do is to choose the parable that will help somebody, will stimulate the thinking of somebody, and open up different perspectives to them. Now I'm finding that this is in the culture of many countries. And while I'm in Africa shortly, it's going to be one of the things I'll be exploring. But the Solomon Islanders go one step further, which absolutely fascinated me. Once they've talked about the story, many of the stories are associated with dance. And so they will do together a dance that brings them into unison and rapport around the nature of the story and the issue. Now, isn't that amazing what we can learn from other cultures?
Absolutely. And I frequently hear the criticism that coaching, or most of the coachings, are very cognitively focused, just conversations. and bringing in, you know, emotions, dance, whatever, that could be a real breakthrough in how we support people. And as you were talking, and I brought in the concept of okay, coaching and mentoring, as you were talking, I was starting to think about more like a learning consultant or a learning supporter or just a developmental support person instead of having the distinctions between coach and mentor.
Yeah. Well, there's this whole area that I find fascinating. It's coaching. Are coaching and mentoring professions or vocations, or as I prefer, something in the middle, a provocation?
Oh, tell me a bit more about that distinction.
Yeah. So if you're a profession, you by all sorts of rules, you have to, and there's a lot of governance around it. If you're a vocation, that is quite the opposite. You do something because it's something you want to, it fills a need within you. You'll give it the way that you want to serve the world. Provocation is something in the middle there. You are able to serve the world through the way that you approach conversations with other people.
That's really deep. And I really like the word that you chose, provocation, because it has an extra sense, an approach on how we should be or we might be approaching those conversations. Because for me, provocation is definitely meaning the challenging of the thoughts of my partners, going beyond boundaries or typical thinking patterns or whatever. So I really, really like that word, provocations. So you mentioned, everything is interesting. So I'm like, wow, I'm caught in all these interesting things that you are saying. So you mentioned that it is the approach of beginner coaches to learn 10 models, formalities, routines, whatever. I do think that it's a good way of getting into a profession, getting into the way of learning coaching. How could we support them? Or what could other coaches do to speed up this process? Because I don't think that this should be skipped. So what's your position? Can we skip working with one model or two and, you know, and learning the basic tropes? Is it possible to skip it and start from a higher level immediately?
Or is that just something
that we can speed through?
That's what we're questioning right now. What can we do? Because if AI is coming rapidly, it's taking over more and more of this. It means that if you don't progress rapidly into more mature coaching, you're going to get left behind. Nobody wants you because you've nothing to offer. And yet, as you say, how do you start to learn how to do it? The evidence that we have so far from the maturity research studies suggests that what we should be doing is giving people the concept, the theory, and some models to use, but enabling them to get to let go of those models as quickly as possible. So it's a bit like a child learning to ride a bicycle. You have stabilizers on it. Most kids, once they get a bit of speed up, they really want to take your please stabilizers off. And you know, jolly well, if you do it, they're going to fall over and then hurt themselves. So you judge it as quickly as possible. You take one stabilizer off, yeah, and then you take the other one off and they're away. And I think that analogy works for me. The emphasis of so much of coach education and coach accreditation in some other bodies is all about sticking to the process. The idea that let's take ICDF accreditation, for example. So you qualify at ACC level, and then you go on to do more of the same, but deeper and better to get PCC and the more of the same and deeper to get MCC. There is no evidence from our research that that's accurate. The reality from the research is that you abandon what you had before as ineffective. You leave it behind. So Mars is about recognizing that you've moved to a completely different level and have different approaches and different ways of doing things. Mastery is about breaking the rules, not sticking to the rules. And so the emphasis of education has got to be on experience, on practicing, on scenarios and working with case studies and just getting in there and doing it.
I love that, especially the breaking the rules part. If I can get back to the bicycle analogy, I love it. My challenge for it is that riding a bicycle has a pretty easily visible purpose. It has wheels, pedals, and it can move in one direction. But so I think it's easy to get the idea of what the bicycle is for. But if we are speaking about these coaching, mentoring combined and learning supports and personal development, whatever, then I think it's not easy to get grasp of what coaching, mentoring, whatever all these are all about. That's why for me,
I agree.
Yeah. A lot more challenging to move up to that level. That's why I think it's important to talk about competencies and boundaries, even through the lenses of breaking the rules. Let me move one question forward. Is that We may not just talk about coaching and mentoring when we talk about this helping profession. So where do you see the boundaries, for example, with other helping professions like counseling or therapy or whatever? So what are the things that we should definitely have to keep in our mind as coaches slash mentors in order to stay in the area where we should be staying? Is there such an area where we should be staying?
So the first thing that distinguishes, and I think is an issue, mentoring from and coaching from other helping professions, is that most of them require people to be on the receiving end. So if you're going to become a counselor, you have to go through lots of counseling yourself. It's mm-hmm. not required, but I think it should be. And what we found has been really helpful in the stories that people have told of their progression as coaches to mature coaches. All of them talk about the value of supervision and different kinds of supervision. Some of them also say, I go to counseling, I go to other forms of self, or what development of self-awareness. And mm-hmm. so it takes you away from doing it. It takes you much more quickly to being. But and then we get to where exactly are the boundaries? Well, I think if we find ourselves trying to cure somebody, we've gone too far. That takes in, we've quite clearly gone into counseling or therapy of some kind. And we just need to have a little warning bell that says, like the sensors on the back of a car that tell us if we're getting too close to the lamppost. We need to have those built into us. And again, how do we learn, teach people to do that? We put them into scenarios where they practice these things. So they have the experience. It's not just something that's intellectual. It's something they've experienced viscerally.
What would be your recommendation to the attendees of the conference in moving forward? Well, we have different coaches here with different experiences. We have mentors, coach mentors. So we have lots of different professionals here. What would be your advice for them on going to the next levels of their careers or to the next levels of their coach / mentoring identities? If there can be one or two general advices that you could make.
We make advances, and although the concept of stage models has come in for a lot of criticism recently, and we, when we did our original studies, we saw the progression of coaches as a stage model. But more recent research hasn't borne that out. And it's much more, people can come in at different levels. So you don't have to come in at that very basic level. You may be able to come in with an experience from elsewhere. So you may have got counseling experience. You may have just be a very wise person. So you don't have to go through all this need for the process stuff. So I've completely forgotten where I was going, where I was coming from. But anyway, let's carry on and we'll see where we go. But the notion that we have to have a starting point, a fixed starting point, I think can be challenged very strongly. However, what we can do is to create dissatisfaction with where we are. And that's the key in a stage. People progress from one level in a stage model by realizing the way that they think about things in that model or that level doesn't work. They seek mentally for different solutions. In a stage model, people expect to only move on essentially when they become dissatisfied with the approaches they have today. They just don't work in the situations that we move them to. And so what that says is, well, okay, I need to rethink this. And so they go out and seek a different way of approaching an issue. We have to build in our capacity for dissatisfaction with where we are. And what we see with so many coaches around is a smugness, if you like. Yeah, it's nice and cozy where they are. I do it this way, and that's his mind, and I'm a great coach because I do. No sense of seeking challenge, seeking, looking. When is it, when could this be better? When is it really working as much well as I think it is? Seeking challenges to the way that we do things. So I like to, in the coaches that I supervise, I recommend that every month they try and one assumption they hold that they can challenge. And then to go out and say, well, is this totally true? Is it not true? Is it only partially true? And constantly to be challenging where they are. I recommend that they go and choose clients who are not similar to themselves. Because most coaches tend to graduate to clients who are actually a bit like them.
Yeah.
So choosing some clients who are neurodiverse, for example, or neurodivergent, as we now call it, say, seeking opportunities to increase our level of dissatisfaction with where we are. And sometimes just reading, you read widely and something comes out of those books that really make us think, or through supervision. In supervision, somebody presents a case that we think, gosh, my normal way of working wouldn't work there. What do I need to acquire in terms of a different perspective? So all of these things, I think that we can do, but it all comes down to increasing our level of self-awareness to see where the assumptions that we hold need to be questioned.
Thank you. I have a professional and a personal question as well. Now, puzzled into which direction I should be steering the conversation. Let me ask the personal one first, and feel free not to answer. What was the latest belief of yours that you have changed recently?
Oh, that's a good question. What's the latest one that I've changed? I've had to challenge quite a bit of my understandings about dementia because of something that I'm involved in and the way that I need to respond to the other person and to other people around them. That's given me a set of different empathies, if you like, and a completely new set of tools for my self-regulation in the face of these issues.
Thank you very much for sharing that. I have one more question, more for the professional side here, is that you said that we should be constantly seeking challenges, breaking more and more barriers as we develop ourselves. And I'd like to circle back to the boundaries of competencies or the roles of boundaries. So when should we stop? You mentioned previously that, well, when you find yourself curing people, that's where you are in the wrong field as a coach. But for me, curing is not a very easily identifiable moment. Because let me use a big word here, provocative, because sickness, with all due respect, is not something that is a clear sign. Most of the times, as I work as a psychologist as well, but my practice is very small, most of the times, people who have real psychological issues, they don't come with them to the therapist or to the counselor. They don't say that, hey, sorry, I have some schizo or whatever, and please help me. They just come with issues like any coach would receive, like, you know, I am disoriented, or I need to find more focus in my work. And then after 10 sessions, it turns out that, well, you have ADHD or something even, you know, more non-healthy-like thing. So what should a coach/mentor do to be more aware of these gradually emerging challenges or, you know, latent issues, name them however we want?
One thing we can do is to increase our level of knowledge around things ADHD or HSP, highly sensitive persons, or Asperger's or whatever. In that context, it's been quite fascinating. We have a project where we are doing a book which is presenting the voices of coaches who themselves ADHD or Asperger's or HSPs, and how they go about coaching. And it's very different, but they can be incredibly effective and HSPs, for example, can sense things that I wouldn't. And so beginning to see things through the eyes of other people who have these different conditions, because we recognize that there is value there. And I think once we recognize this value, we can start to appreciate just the interaction that they have. And that leads us to understand our clients better. We're just starting a supervision group solely for people who are neurodivergent coaches, for neurodivergent coaches, so they can actually come together and explore how they can be authentic in their coaching and really value using themselves. It's getting that awareness of these different areas and actually questioning how we go about the assumptions that we make. And that just helps us to see things differently and to appreciate and value the difference. So one of the things that gives us concern is that there's been a rise of courses that see how to deal with your neurodivergent clients. Problem with them all is that, or not all of them, but the majority of the ones that we've seen, all assume that the neurodivergent person has, it's a problem for them. You know, that they have it's an illness or what, but it's in that, they may call it an illness, but they have a problem. They need to adjust the world around them. When actually, it's not so simple as that. It's actually how the world adjusts to them that's far more important and relevant. So we've got lots of different issues to really try and understand things from those perspectives. But so just getting to understand the way that they think, or other different people think, is really helpful.
Thank you. If I could put a warning signal here, is it that I have seen it frequently when people learn about the new fields, they don't just learn the boundaries from these studies that, okay, this is where I don't go. Sometimes they get the self-confidence to go there because they have the impression, okay, now I know this, so I can go there, I work there, I can coach or whatever there. My warning signal here is that I think we should pay more attention to the facts that where we can really have an impact or where we may not have an impact. And I think this is where we could open a new conversation about interventions in coaching, mentoring, or in therapy or counseling, because I think there is a difference in the kinds of interventions that these helping professions may be using.
It's so tempting, and it's a real issue in safeguarding. When you've got a little knowledge of what constitutes ADHD or any of these traits, and you start to diagnose, you say, ah, yes. And then coach says, well, have you thought that you might have ADHD? Oh, ouch. Yeah, this is a breach. This is an ethical breach, undoubtedly, because you're not qualified to make a diagnosis. And you say, well, I'm not making a diagnosis, but you are. You're suggesting this to somebody. But what you can do is to recommend them to some reading around different levels, different kinds of divergence. And that's fine. That fits within the ethical boundaries. And then the person may come back to you and say, well, having looked at that, I think probably X or Y. And you say, well, do you feel that you need to go and get a formal diagnosis of this? And sometimes they say yes, and sometimes they say no. But you fulfilled your objective. You may suspect it, and you may be right, or you may be wrong, but it's not for you to make that decision. So we have to be, that's a real clear boundary that we have. I found it really helpful over the years to deliberately partner up with a therapist work with the same client. Now, there's a lot of discussion, should you or shouldn't you? The answer is the coach or the mentor can provide very different, more immediate, specifically practical support, while the therapist can actually help somebody with a much deeper level of self-understanding and developing not just self-awareness, but self-efficacy. And talking with the therapist about how your approach is gives you a greater sensitivity to where the boundaries lie.
Thank you very much. And with your last sentences, you really circled back to the start of our conversation as well, how these helping professions can work together, because what I'm hearing is your alliance with a therapist, both in the case of client work and both in the case of learnings on talking with them increases our sensitivity. I did hear a comment on, we could open this up. I know that coaching/mentoring could be more focused on the practical, a bit more practical aspect of development rather than the deeper self-awareness things that we should be giving to all the therapists. And I know that deeper is an interesting question that we could be dissecting here on the long term. What does deeper mean? Fortunately, we have supervisors for that. And what I really liked in what you said is the importance of ethics. So it's not just the boundaries of competencies or which profession should do what, but what does our code of ethics say about what we should be doing or how we should be approaching certain problems. So for me, ethics is sometimes more important than competency boundaries. And I dare to say this in front of the audience of the conference. Fortunately, I'm not there just like you virtually, so they cannot have their revenge on me for that.
I think for the audience, many of you will be aware of the sense of competencies or standards, and the two things are not the same. So a competency tends to be much more prescriptive, where standards are much more. So competencies confine you, standards basically provide a basis on which you can jump. So there is a distinction between the two. But there's a lot of criticism from our, particularly that we're identifying in our coach maturity work, around where are competencies beneficial and where are they part of the problem? And one of the issues that comes up is that competencies are almost always based upon the past. They're backward looking. This is what people who define themselves or have been defined as being good coaches, this is what they do. So you analyze the practice of competent practitioners. But when we look to the future, the competencies required. Artificial intelligence, for example, how do we use that? How do we use virtual reality? All of these things, these are competencies. And there are, and so we're beginning to see that the competencies need to embrace a future orientation as well as a past orientation. Now, how we do that, that's an interesting challenge.
Thank you for saying that. Unfortunately, we are getting to the end of our time. So what I would like just to ask for is closing words. So is there some final, you know, wisdom, one more advice that you would like to share with the audience of the conference before we close down this part of your being with us and hopefully move to the more interactive parts of from the recording?
So thank you, Dolly. I think to everybody, I'd just like to say this is the most exciting time in coaching and mentoring that we've ever had. There is so much change going on. There's so much potential. And one of the ways, the baskets that we put this in, is looking at the level of complexity that we're working with. We've identified 10 levels of complexity in coaching. And at the moment, we're just most coaches are just dealing with levels 1, 2, and maybe 3. But when you get into team coaching, you're sort of halfway through. When you get to coaching teams of teams, when you're getting coaching all the way up to coaching the meta system, we have the potential to work in all 10 areas. And what we have to do in coach education and in our own self-development and self-awareness as coaches, if we want, the more we want to add value, what the way to add greater value is to actually deal or work at greater levels of complexity. When we're working with a team, we're delivering far more value than we are working with an individual, for example. So how do we actually enable ourselves to take advantage of all of this potential? Because the world is getting more complicated. It needs coaches, and it needs coaches who are complexity aware. So we're entering a period of fantastic opportunity. In many places, we don't know how we're going to contribute. We just know that somebody needs to step into that space to do it. And there isn't anybody else. There's no other profession that has the capacity to do this. I think that's amazing.
Thank you very much, David. And thank you very much for all your wise words and for your time with us. I'd just like to say a big thank you on behalf of all of us here in the conference and on behalf of the whole organizing committee and everyone who did their job in making this conference happen. Thank you very much.
And I'd like to say my thank yous to all of you for being coaches, mentors, and supervisors, because the world needs you.
Thank you for listening to On Coaching Podcast, where I have curious conversations with world-renowned coaches and researchers. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to rate us and subscribe. I also invite you to visit zoltanchigesh.com, where you can access more resources regarding the coaching industry. Be well!